You're listening to Distilling Theology.
I'm Blake.
And I'm Justin.
And this is a podcast pairing discussions of theology and distilled spirits.
And dad jokes.
Amen.
What's wrong with you people?
You're not David.
I don't know why you're clapping. I'm talking about you. Fatality.
You know, starting a podcast about theology and distilled spirits is whiskey business. I said that with a straight face.
This is
Distilling Theology.
Welcome, young and old, all who are here. It is I, the Baptist, the host, the co-host, the bearded one of Distilling Theology. Guys, it has been a week since I've seen you last, and I'm here again, but I'm not alone. I'm never alone. I'm here with my lovely, kind, humorous, handsome co-host. Blake, how are you, my friend?
I don't know, man. The amount of manly compassion happening here is making me making me a little concerned.
Well, I feel like we're always busting on each other, you know? So
it's fair. It's fair.
Let people know once in a while that I still love you.
That's good, man. You know, brothers in the Lord. And while we're here having some bromance, we're not alone, because of course not. We are thrilled to be joined by the guys of PresbyCast, known for a very long time only as Chortles Weekly and Resbyterian. Guys, welcome. Welcome to Distilling Theology. Thanks for spending some time tonight.
Great to be here. Thanks for having us.
That's awesome. I've been catching up a lot on y'all's General Assembly conversations, and I'm sure we'll get into that a bit, but give me the quick, like, elevator pitch. What, for those that aren't familiar, what is PresbyCast, and how did you guys get this thing off the ground?
I mean, kind of the elevator pitch was, we're just two confessional Presbyterian guys who wanted to do a podcast that sort of connected everything back to the local church. So we started in 2016. So early June, we had just had our sixth anniversary episode. Us and the Wire share anniversary dates. They obviously, their years a little before ours, but our first episode is also, their first episode was also on a June 3rd. So man has to have a code and whatnot. But I actually pitched Brad on it. I'd taken some inspiration from some other YouTube shows at the time, and you just kind of look around and you're like, you know, we could do this with very little effort. We really don't search out for topics because they generally, it's quite self-evident what you're going to end up talking about. Things just sort of happen. But our gimmick was always wanting to connect things back to how they affect the local church. And a big part of that was having some of our weird friends and connecting people on Twitter who normally you just see them as a disembodied user image, actually being able to hear their voice and whatnot. So we started small. Someone once described us as polished but not slick, and I try to hold us to that as much as I can.
As well, excellent. You should.
That's great. That's great. Uh-huh. So you guys have been doing this a long time then. So that's awesome. As experienced professionals, seasoned professionals now, what advice would you give to us, the young and the unwise?
But not young, restless. We're both confessional. Let's put that right on the table right now.
Well, Resby needs to tell you one of the only rule of PresbyCast. So Resby, share that with him.
No beer reviews. So we have very few, very few rules. We don't do beer reviews, and I think the second rule is we're a strictly anti-communist podcast.
Boy, man.
Sort of the first one is official. The second one, you know, is an ethos.
We affirm.
And so
we agree with that.
Yeah. So, I mean, not hard. You'd think the first one would be hard to, would be easy as well. But when we started in 2016, everyone's gimmick was beer reviews. So, it was beer reviews. And at the time, Calvinist bracket, insert superhero name, closed bracket. And so we sort of set out to not do that. And shortly thereafter, the superheroes died. Electronically, well, speaking, of course.
Well, now in 2022, everybody's gimmick is communism. So,
and there it is, folks.
I know. Yeah, it's I'm Polish, so it's like I get to hate communists and Nazis in equal measure. I mean, it's really a,
excellent.
It's a great way station.
That's excellent. Well, in light of not doing beer reviews, we are going to sip a whiskey, which is, you know, it was beer at one point. So I guess we're on that. You know, when we started, we had a lot of jokes about, well, we're not that other reformed podcast with two guys in their 20s or 30s drinking alcohol and talking about theology. We're different because it's distilled now. So, and that's kind of, you know, this should be episode 98 by my count. So I think the gimmick worked. For now, we'll see.
Now, explain something to me. Uh-oh. Justin's a Baptist.
He is.
Indeed, I am.
A bourbon sipping Baptist. So
it's because it's because we've abandoned all fundamentalism.
I mean, conversely, I was just going to say it's because there's no way to execute church discipline consistently. Anyways, you'll just go to a different congregation. Sorry, it's the president. Listen, you guys, there were three Baptists last week, and I was, you know, I have to save all this energy for tonight. So we're good. Tonight in our glass, we've got Evan Williams White Label, which is bottled in bond. According to the label, Evan Williams is historically recognized as Kentucky's first distiller of bourbon, opening his distillery in 1783, which puts him relatively proximate to the American revision to both, well, you know, national existence, but also I was going to say the Westminster Confession. They say the whiskey is a genuine sour mash that honors his pioneering heritage. And since it's bonded, as we've talked about, 100 proof, aged at least 4 years, it's in this beautiful white label bottle. I picked up mine in Indiana for like $18, which is pretty great. And, yeah, we just had this cause I reached out to these guys on Twitter. Let me back that up. I tweeted a meme at them and said, want to hang out sometime. And someone over there, I'm assuming it was you, Brad, responded. And, you know, here we are.
Indeed.
And I said, what do you want to sip? Cause we usually defer to the guests. And he said, he's got some of this handy. So, is there any particular reason you like to have this handy? Is it just happenstance? Well, obviously we're Calvinists, so we're not having,
I'm a cheapskate.
Well, amen. It's great for the price. Like there's nothing wrong with this guy. So,
my wife is very frugal, says I'm the cheapest person she's ever met in her life. And that's really saying something because she works with and is related to some cheap people. So that's who I am.
It's a badge of honor. It's good. It's good.
Many years ago, probably, over 35 years ago, I knew a guy. I didn't drink bourbon then. And he called Evan Williams Evil Williams. And so that just made me think, you know, it can't be good. I don't know where I heard about the white label bottled in bond, but the value appealed to me. And it's not bad, but we'll talk about that.
We shall. Yeah, it's, I mean, Justin, I feel like we've said this because we've had bourbons for the last couple episodes, but it's very classic bourbon smell, very classic, like caramels, yeah, and corns and
brown sugar, honey, vanilla, you know, kind of stuff.
The things, you know, let's just sip it. And I'm really just excited to get into talking about, you know, what makes Presbyterians Presbyterian. I'm picturing in my mind, I'm going to do that thing where I try to describe a meme verbally, but the Ben Shapiro meme, you know, why are they, why do Presbyterians practice a Presbyterian polity? It's in the name, Presbyterian. So, you know, on that terrible joke note, cheers. Let's take a sip. That's actually a bit oakier on the palate than I remember. Not in a bad way, though. Again,
no, it's
$18. I'm not, I have no complaints about that.
I mean, I didn't pay $18. I paid $26, but
yeah,
you know,
we're in the People's Republic of New York right now, so
it's not bad. I mean, it's similar to the smell. You get some of that caramel and vanilla, but there's like, I don't know, figs, cherries, a little bit of floral nuttiness, a little bit of oak. It's not bad.
I could see the nuttiness. I don't know about the cherries.
Speaking of figs.
Oh, this is actually question. The most pressing question of the night, probably.
This is, we like to ask our guests this question because it is incredibly important to the history of distilling theology. Yay or nay, Fig Newtons?
Well, Resby and I don't agree a lot on culinary matters. I've eaten them. I'm never going to go out of my way to eat one on purpose, but if they're there, I may eat them. But Resby probably has really strong feelings. So, Resby.
I have never eaten a Fig Newton. However, nevertheless, I don't plan. I feel like I've got a really good streak going there. And I have no plans to break it.
Wise choice.
I think anytime you start introducing fruit into cookies, I think it's
you messed
just,
up.
We've already got enough people trying to, you know, just insert their fitness regimens in places where no one is talking about it. And I don't think that we need to insert health food into cookies.
Well, all right. Make that love it. 2-0 for Team Newtons this week. That was, I don't know. I'm worried about the rest of this episode at that point, but no, we're good. That was something that came up. I forgot how, and it spiraled into ridiculous proportions to the point that we had like 30 minutes to interview Carl Truman about Rise and Triumph, and we wasted 3 of them talking about Fig Newtons. So it was pretty important to us at the time. But on that note, before we get into our Presby distinctives. As always, guys, we're going to open with a prayer from the Valley of Vision. This is, I have the bonded leather edition. This is page 98, and it is the prayer titled Victory, which the post mill, Justin, lit up when I told him the prayer name. So here we are. I'm just a poor optimistic mill, we'll call it that. But anyways, enough of that. We'll pray and get into it. So, O divine Redeemer, great was thy goodness in undertaking my redemption, in consenting to be made sin for me, in conquering all my foes. Great was thy strength in enduring the extremities of divine wrath, in taking away the load of my iniquities. Great was thy love in manifesting thyself alive, in showing thy sacred wounds, that every fear might vanish and every doubt be removed. Great was thy mercy in ascending to heaven, in being crowned and enthroned, there to intercede for me, there to succor me in temptation, there to open the eternal book, there to receive me finally to thyself. Great was thy wisdom in devising this means of salvation. Bathe my soul in rich consolations of thy resurrection life. Great was thy grace in commanding me to come hand in hand with knee to the Father, to be knit to him eternally, to discover in him my rest, to find in him my peace, to behold his glory, to honor him who is alone worthy, in giving me the Spirit as teacher, guide, power, that I may live repenting of sin, conquer Satan, find victory in life. When thou art absent, all sorrows are here. When thou art present, all blessings are mine. Amen. Always a blessing.
It is indeed. Now, listen, y'all. We spent a considerable amount of time with our dear friend Joe talking about Congregationalist polity. And now, because we are fair, we are going to now open the floor to speak about Presbyterian polity. These are these are the only areas truly where Blake and I really butt heads, essentially polity, eschatology, and covenant theology.
A little thing about sacraments.
Granted, now, well, again, it's included in our covenant theology, right? Our sacramentology. Now, granted, we agree doctrinally. Again, we've said this a million times on like almost everything. But this is what distinguishes us. These are our distinctives. And so in light of that, we wanted to have some lovely folks on to talk about Presbyterian polity, to describe what that is. Now, either one of you, if you want to just dive in, in a nutshell, what is Presbyterian polity in summary? And then we'll expound on that from there.
Well, some people are, you know, creeped out by the word rule, but it just means governing. So I think the classic definition would be churches that are ruled by a plurality of elders, meaning not one, more than one, ideally, you know, two, three, five, six, seven. There are some large PCA churches that have, you know, 100 elders on their session, believe it or not. Not my church. So you have a plurality of elders, each having an equal vote on the local church session. And then the Presbyterian churches in a geographical area will all meet together. They'll send representatives from local churches that comprises the presbytery. Presbytery comes from the Greek word presbyteros, which means elder. So we have elders on the session. We have all of our elders are members, or not all members. All pastors are members of presbytery, and then ruling elders participate as well. So it's a series of graded courts. Usually those courts are local session, regional, and sometimes pretty local, like one metropolitan area in some cases. But the local church session, the regional presbytery, and then in the PCA, you jump to the General Assembly, which is the national denomination-wide court. Some Presbyterian churches refer to that top level as a synod, S-Y-N-O-D, but some very large churches will have a synod between presbyteries and General Assembly. So some Presbyterian bodies have four courts, some have three. Some call that top court a synod. Some call it the General Assembly, and that's what the OPC and the PCA and probably two or three other denominations in North America call them General Assembly. But that's the main structure of it. But the outstanding feature is the plurality of elders, meaning those elders are chosen by the congregation. So there's a congregational element. But the decisions are made, church discipline, major financial decisions, reception of members, control of the preaching and the ministries of the church are handled by the session. So that's really the one man is not in charge. The congregation is not in charge. I mean, the congregation has to vote on their officers. They nominate and vote on elders and deacons. They must be given the chance to vote on major financial purchases like real property, you know, big deal things. Most pastors, and unfortunately we have what's called assistant pastors, associate pastors, and senior pastors. Assistant pastors are actually in the PCA, and I don't don't think anybody likes this, but they're sort of hired and fired by the session. Associate pastors and senior pastors are hired and called by the by the congregation. So assistant pastors are sort of a glitch in the system. It takes something away from the congregation. So that's in the PCA is what's called a grassroots denomination. There's more power in the local church than in any of the courts above, really. It's very easy to leave the PCA. You can leave in a couple of weeks, with a congregational vote and you're gone. Where there are other Presbyterian denominations that are more hierarchical, and we can get into that if we talk about history. But there's a strong congregational element in PCA polity, and there's some congregational element in all Presbyterian polity. Now, Resby is in the OPC now, the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, and he may or may not want to say some things about how it differs. But most Presbyterian churches are more alike than they are different.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have much data. I mean, if you look at a fairly confessional PCA church and your run-of-the-mill OPC church, you're probably not going to notice a whole bunch of differences. I'm sure somebody from way up north or somebody from way down south is going to have significant disagreement with that assessment, but I think it's pretty fair. Brad gave the long answer. I usually jokingly say, it's Presbyterian because it's biblical. We sort of enjoy the whimsical sincerity with which we hold our beliefs. I think is one of the things that I think first attracts those who we call the Presby curious to Presbyterianism is just the idea that you can hold something, you can believe something so much that you can joke about it and just not even. I think probably more people become Presbyterian because of our show, because of the goofy jokes, than some of our more serious content potentially, which is a weird providence of Twitter. The major difference between PCA and OP is the OP is technically a three office. And then there's some difference on, which documents out of the Westminster Assembly are considered, constitutionally binding. But I have not been in the denomination all that long relative to its history. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'm very happy to be there.
Must be nice to be, from the progressive church in America going to the only perfect church, as they say.
Well, we didn't, we didn't set out to do that. I think if there had been a confessionally subscription PCA church nearby, we probably already would have been there, but if there had been another one within reasonable driving distance, we probably would have ended up there as well, just as things turned out. The OP, there was one, some distance to the south, and then the one we found and ended up at was about the same distance to the north. So it kind of worked out.
Yeah, my wife and I drive. I mean, it's not crazy. It's like half an hour for our PCA church on Sunday mornings.
We're about 35 to 40.
Yeah.
So
I walk about 100 yards to get to church in the morning. Morning.
Well, there's a saying in the most of the South that you you can't swing a dead cat without hitting a Baptist church. So they are very local, at least. In the little county I live in that has 20,000 people, I'm sure there are 200 Baptist churches.
How many of them are Reformed, though?
One used to be. And I think that guy went to Louisville. It was years ago. I've got a friend who that was part of his authentically broken faith journey. It was a stop at a church right down the road from me, but I don't know the state of it today. It's hard to be Calvinist. Well, so the correct answer to your question, how many of them are Reformed, was that none, because there never has been a Reformed Baptist church. But just granting your terms, I don't know. I don't think so.
That was beautiful. It's nice to hear these things coming from someone that's not me. even if we're in, you know, it's also nice to have someone where I'm kind of the mid baritone, to have someone who's actually a true bass on the podcast is very nice. it adds gravitas and weight to the words, if for no other reason than it makes people's speakers and headphones rumble. So, no,
it's, do you guys run into people listening to your podcast like more than 1x speed? Because this is a heresy we just have to expunge from the church. It's you poll your listeners, how many of them are listening at like 1.5 or even faster? Mm-hmm. It's awful.
See,
we have some 2Xers.
Whoa.
Oh my goodness. How can they even understand?
We're not proud of it.
It's not even like, I think it's even sicker than that. Like let's be a little self-deprecating. Could you imagine loving podcasts that much that you have to speed up them so that you can listen to more of them?
You know, yeah. That's a good question. To be fair, my brother, who's a journalist, listens, apparently, I don't know if he still does this, but there was a moment in time where he could listen to Ben Shapiro speak at 3x speed, which the man already speaks at 3x speed. So I don't know how that's humanly possible to digest that information. But
wow, that's impressive.
Know, I'll have to take notes from him someday as to how he does that. I don't know if he could do the same for Al Mohler on the briefing, but you know, who knows? That rapid fire thing is too much for me. I like to I pour a glass of whiskey and have a conversation, you know, and talk about things. So those are helpful lead-ins to what Presbyterianism is. We can get into history in a minute, but
let me mention the two office, three office
thing. That's where I was going.
It has to be mentioned. So in the OPC, you've got deacon, I don't know if they call them ruling elders or just elders, and then pastors. So that's three offices. The PCA being a Southern Presbyterian church in heritage. It was the Southern Presbyterians in the 19th century that sort of rediscovered Presbyterian polity and really looked into what had gone on in Scotland, and then made, you know, looked at the Bible and came up with some of their own, I won't say innovations, but they pulled some things out of Scripture and developed some principles that might have been somewhat new, although they probably also always all had been present somewhere. But sort of the what the Southern Presbyterians majored on was ecclesiology and polity. And the Southern Presbyterians had this concept of the parity of elders, meaning that a ruling elder, while he may not preach, he has as much voice in the courts of the church and in the governance of the local church as the pastor, the teaching elder. So in the PCA, we say there's one office of elder. It's differentiated by the fact that teaching elders are the preachers, the teachers of the word primarily in the church. But they have this, so we say there's one office with two classes, ruling and teaching. And that's the difference. Not all Presbyterian churches view it that way. But I'm more and more convinced over time and over the years that that's the right way to approach it. So that's all I'll say on that. Some people say that in effect, because, you know, sort of even in the PCA, the teaching elders are more equal than others, as the saying goes. So some people say we sort of are a de facto three office denomination, or we're a 2.5 office denomination. but really, for the purposes of the court, we all have the same vote. and the same right of access.
One thing I'd like to dive into at some point, because you briefly mentioned earlier, you said you're Presbyterian because it's biblical, and as much as I enjoy that, I want to talk about scripturally where, because we did this last episode with Joe Thorne, we want to jump into how scripturally you derive from the text your Presbyterianism. So where does that come from the text, and how did you guys get to this, as it were?
Well, let me first, I don't have all these verses memorized. I'll look up a couple, but my pastor was a Southern Baptist, and he became a Presbyterian at a Southern Baptist seminary, and he read the Bible, and one of the things he noticed was that when it comes to elders, they were always mentioned in plural in the New Testament. There was never a single pastor. Now, we understand that Paul was an evangelist. He was an apostle. He had special powers that we sometimes say that we grant to a church planner to examine elders and to appoint people to things without a lot of outside consultation, but that's not the norm. So you'll see, there's a verse where Peter basically says, I'm just one of the guys. I'm an elder like the rest of you. And I don't remember what verse that is, but, so my pastor became a Presbyterian, studying the New Testament, and he didn't know what Presbyterians were. He was speaking to someone one day, and he told them what he had found in the scriptures, and they said, well, you're a Presbyterian. Well, he was raised in the home of a Baptist preacher. He'd never heard of Presbyterians, didn't know what they were. He truly became...
They're snake handlers.
Yeah, he truly became a Presbyterian by conviction, by reading the Bible, and without any outside influence or propaganda at all. So I'm not saying that proves it, but there's certainly... that story gets repeated time and time again. Now with the internet, everybody can, you can look up anything and be an expert in 10 minutes, allegedly. But in days past, there were people who arrived at these convictions just by looking at the scripture. But if you pull out your Bible app and you put in the word elders in the search bar, you find that it's almost always mentioned in plural. And here's the verse. Now, Peter, the alleged head of the church, the rock, the first pope, air quotes, okay? Peter wrote in 1 Peter 5:1, therefore, I exhort the elders among you as your fellow elder, okay? One of the apostles, as your fellow elder and witness of the sufferings of Christ, and a partaker also of the glory that is to be revealed. That's 1 Peter 5:1. So Peter, he was an apostle, but he was an elder, and he spoke to the leaders of New Testament churches, he says, I'm your fellow elder. So what does that mean? So he didn't mean I'm your fellow pastor. I'm just a local church pastor like you, because he wasn't that. But if you look at the words, elders are almost always mentioned in plural. In the Baptist world, I grew up Baptist, Southern Baptist. The deacons function like elders, sort of, but they're called deacons. Deacons in the Southern Baptist Church don't do what deacons do in churches in the Bible. And we know that generally, unless it's a big church, there's one pastor, and there aren't a plurality of elders. There aren't more than one, and they certainly don't have equal power. I like to say, with Baptist churches, they'll typically vacillate between a pastor who's sort of like a local pope, or the congregation, which can rule like a mob, And sometimes it just changes from month to month, you know, who has the ascendancy, and whether how people, you know, the pastor's party, may give him a lot of power, but they may take it away just like that too. So, but anyway, the plurality of elders is a big deal. And I think it's fairly evident. If you look at the Greek, we would hold that bishops and elders are the same thing, that we don't have bishops in the hierarchical sense, that the words presbyteros for elder and episcopos for bishop are used interchangeably. And so that's why we don't invest power in a single bishop. And we don't think that even in the local church that one elder is above the rest. Now, you may or may not know this, plurality of elders was not uncommon in, say, colonial Baptist churches. Early mm-hmm. Baptist churches often used the word elders, but that fell away, they became less biblical, I think, than they were at one time, let's say 200 years ago, 150 or 75 years ago. So that's what, you know, so that's where we see the office of elder in the plurality, just looking at the plain reading of the New Testament. But then for the idea of graded courts, in other words, the buck doesn't stop on every matter at the local church, that the local churches are accountable. The Jerusalem Council in Acts 15, that's a good example of that. Now, you know, we don't read about presbytery meetings in the Bible, but you know, when we look at the sort of governance in Israel that Moses set up, and when we look at the narrative in the New Testament in the epistles, where the elders are clearly accountable to one another, meet together. And sometime on big questions, they meet together to decide major doctrinal issues. We would say that's like a general assembly. We would say that the first general assembly of the New Testament Presbyterian Church was in Jerusalem. But anyway, that's where most of that comes from. Another thing, a lot of Baptists don't know, even in the country, Southern Baptist churches, when local church pastors meet together to examine and ordain a new man, a new minister, you know what they call that meeting? They call it a presbytery. So even Baptists do use the word sometimes, although it's very informal typically. But anyway, that's where we find it in the scriptures. And you know, there's some good books by I think it's Thomas Witherow, Witherow, the Apostolic Church, Which Is It? That's a good short book. There's a more recent book by Guy Waters called How Jesus Runs the Church, and there are many others. A lot of them are from the 19th century because that was the explosion of ecclesiological writing among the Presbyterians.
I do want to point out for those listening, Baptist churches that are confessional, which would hold to the 1689, do have elders and deacons, and we do use that terminology. It's in our confession as well. That is interesting too that they use the term presbytery.
Where'd you get that confession?
what we did is we took the rough draft and we made the final masterpiece before handing it in.
Oh man, there it is. Well, that brings me to, we've talked about the different courts of the church, and I know I've mentioned some of the goings on at the most recent General Assembly. And guys, if you want a much more extensive conversation about that, just go to PresbyCast in your podcatcher and listen to the last couple episodes, because they were doing episodes live from General Assembly and after the fact. So if you want a longer sense of what actually happened, I mean, you could also go watch the stream. I think it's still available if you want to be a real nerd like me and some of the guys from my church. We got together the Sunday after it ended, and we were sitting there talking to one of our pastors. My wife was like rearing to go and do something at like get on with something else that we had to do. And I'm sitting there like talking about somebody at an Olympic sport as we're talking through the different overtures. And so I guess as we talk about that, like, and I know it, I think it's, I don't know the full difference because I'm PCA, I'm a member of a PCA church, but Resby, can you speak to that a little bit? What, if, how, if at all, does that process look different in the OPC versus the PCA? I mean, obviously we have just economy of scale, but that process of overtures being brought before the floor of General Assembly, is it the same kind of procedure in the OPC, or does it look somewhat different? Or if you don't know, that's okay. And I'm sorry for putting you on the spot, because we can't all be perfect.
No, it's okay. I'm comfortable being a moron. It's one of those. So I can speak to it a little bit. I mean, the biggest thing, I mean, you're right in terms of scale, just from a denominational membership standpoint, the PCA just dwarfs the OPC. We're very, very small, and as such have taken steps to make sure that General Assembly stays as small as possible by doing a delegated assembly. So rather than, you know, a more wide open invitation, there's delegates from, you know, from the presbyteries who will go and attend. You know, there are overtures, there's a docket, it all, you know, runs very smoothly. You know, we've joked about it.
People decent and in order.
Yeah. And we've joking, you know, we've joked about it a bit on the show. And, I think when, sort of a preview with, I think Camden Busey was on, but there is no calling of the question at OPCGA. Typically, the docket and the timing of it is set up so that debate can and should continue until everyone who's spoken has spoken, and then it would be moved. So it's one of those. Sometimes there'll be a guy who doesn't realize that and will call the question and get sort of a couple of looks around the room like, is this serious? Like, you know, a couple of retractions or whatnot. But those are, you know, kind of the, I guess you could say the, from a procedural standpoint, those would be.
Oh, we lost you for a minute there, Resby. Let me interject that.
Wow.
I think the OPC General Assembly has 150 to 200 people there, somewhere like that, and you know, the PCA is roughly 10 times as large as the OPC, and our assembly is 10 times as large. Even though we're not delegated, we have about the same proportional representation in two different ways. In one way, again, we have, you know, you have 200 people, or 150 to 200 at OPC. We've had over 2,000 the past, you know, two general assemblies, so it's proportionally the same size. But then most of the really important business at our assembly gets done at our delegated overtures committee, and it's about the same size as the OPC General Assembly. So proportionally, we're the same. The PCA General Assembly should be delegated. It's too large. But really, if you're a OPC elder, you're about as likely to be at General Assembly as a PCA elder is, because it's about the same proportionally. And then we're an all comers. Any teaching elder can go. And a certain proportional number of ruling elders can go from every church. So controversy is what's driven the larger assemblies recently.
Yeah, I think if you want to continue with the differences, the lodging usually looks a lot different. Typically, the OP assembly, everyone will stay on site. And you know, you kind of eat meals together. And so they've been at different universities, places where, you know, modest dorm accommodations can be used, and the catering there. So it, it looks a little different, but yeah, Brad is right. Mathematically, it's about the same proportion of the size there.
No, that's helpful for sure. And speaking to that, you already alluded to the controversy side, and we don't have to get into the whole specifics of that, because we've touched on it a little here. And if you guys want to hear more, just go to PresbyCast, or, you know, Todd and Carl have talked about it ad nauseum on Mortification of Spin. So there are places to go if you want to dive in that, and we'll probably do a whole episode, maybe have a couple people on to talk about the particular controversy driving in the PCA around revoice theology. I thought y'all had, or the Presby Girls episode with Rosaria Butterfield was just excellent. I was blown away. Like, she pulled exactly zero punches and leveled, I think leveled what is a very faulty theology with a lot of compassion for the people that are individually struggling with particular besetting sin. But that said, Brad, you alluded to this, that the controversy drives people to General Assembly. Can you speak to that a little bit over the last couple of years, with us being this grassroots denomination, with these movements to inject more ruling elders into General Assembly? What's that all about, and kind of what is, and has that effort really come to anything, and is it, and what was the thought behind that?
Well, at the first General Assembly in 1973, there were more ruling elders present than there were pastors, teaching elders. And our own retired stated clerk, Roy Taylor, he wrote that the PCA was actually formed primarily through the action of ruling elders. They had, you know, they had the conviction and the time to devote to forming a new denomination. And the ruling elders were just as important, if not more so, in the formation of the denomination than were the pastors. So that's our legacy. But slowly, I mean, the very next year in 1974, I think the General Assembly was close to 50-50. And since then, steadily decreased, the participation of ruling elders has, to the point that going back, you know, about a decade, if you, I think the 10-year average after last year was 23.2% of people at General Assembly were ruling elders. And there's just been a decline since, especially in the 90s and the 2000s. And we had 31.5% ruling elders there this year. So that's a huge increase. You know, it makes a difference. So, you know, my theory is that well, and a lot of people agree, General Assembly, it's so big, and it's sort of become a pastor's club. So a ruling elder, you know, who burns a week of vacation or takes a week off from work unpaid, or pays someone to work for him, which is what I have to do when I go, you get there, it's confusing, it's big, it seems like a lot of the stuff is you know, sort of predetermined. It seems like you're just along for the ride. You can't just go once every 10 years and figure it out. You've got to go 3-4 years before it's really it makes sense to you. So there's the learning curve, there's the financial and time barrier. So I guess inevitably, especially as the PCA became less of a Southeastern denomination, you just weren't going to have as much ruling elder participation. But that principle of parity is built in. So all of our committees are almost all are 50-50, are supposed to be, or can be, 50-50 ruling elders and teaching elders. So that our overtures committee, there are always more pastors than ruling elders. Because you know, some presbyteries can't fill the ruling elder slots for a committee, but it's almost always closer to 50-50 than the assembly is. And typically, over the last 20 years, I think most people agree that the overtures committee votes more, you know, again, air quotes, because we're all conservative, we're all confessional. But the Overtures Committee seems to be more conservative than the wider assembly. And a lot of people have attributed that to the fact of more ruling elders. This year, I think arguably, the assembly was more conservative than the Overtures Committee in some ways, or more bolder, at least, in some of the things that they would support. But maybe that's because we had an extra, you know, 10% of ruling elders there, or 6% as compared to the last couple of years. So, you know, there's this idea that things that teaching elders might be able to nuance or find a way to support, or that because they might have sympathy with fellow pastors, or because they're just sort of insiders, there are some things they would go for or support or not oppose, that a ruling elder coming in who, you know, is not a professional Presbyterian, who may just have a different view of some things. Maybe ruling elders live more in the real world than pastors do. Now, that's not always true, but there is a perspective that ruling elders bring. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of extremely capable, bright, theologically sophisticated ruling elders. And, you know, a guy can stand up at a General Assembly in a committee or on the floor and say something, and you'll be hard pressed to be able to guess whether that guy's a ruling elder or a teaching elder in some cases. Very impressive men, but ruling elders bring a little something different. And I think that's part of the genius of Southern Presbyterianism in particular.
So one thing I'm curious about, one thing we've seen in a lot of other denominations, and to some degree in some of the Reformed denominations, is dealing with theological corruption, right? Letting things like critical race theory or the woke stuff working its way into the church. What does the Presbyterian model have in place to prevent or to mitigate or to deal with that kind of potential for top-down corruption that could really, right? You know, there's denominations that have gone liberal in that way. So what can that offer to kind of prevent that sort of thing from happening?
Well, I think it's the parity of elders, really. I think it's the diverse, the fact that we're not top down, that we don't have a steering committee. Now, we have in the past had committees maybe overstep, permanent committees that, you know, that I think one of our study committees was more or less proposed by this I think it was called the Cooperative Ministries Committee, CMC. And they basically proposed something, and it was sort of controversial, and it didn't come from a church or a presbytery. It came from a committee, and that smacked of top down, you know, central planning a little too much for some of us. That's about 7 years ago. But typically, the fact that that we don't have one man or a small committee or some elites running the show should be a firewall against certain unwise things, or, you know, borderline heretical things, or things that are too cultural, too maybe reckless in some way, or maybe taking us beyond what the church should do. I really think the presence of ruling elders is a huge, we'd be a different denomination today if we had always had equal representation at all the courts of the church between ruling elders and teaching elders. I don't doubt that. Someone sent me a quote today from, I think it was from the 60s or 70s. It was someone from the CRC, the Dutch church, which, you know, the conservatives largely left it to form the URC, maybe 20 years ago, I think. But, you know, that this guy was writing, he said the only hope for the CRC is for the I think he called them the lay elders or laymen, They have different terms in the continental churches, but basically said the only hope for this church is the ruling elders. And he says no church has ever correct, you know, churches rarely, when they get on a slide, they rarely self-correct. And the only way it can be done is if the lay people and, you know, their officers make the correction and get involved. It's generally, I don't think there's ever been a Presbyterian or Reformed church led into apostasy or error or heresy by ruling elders. It's usually come from the pastors, from the seminaries, from the committees, from the agencies. So that is the genius of Presbyterianism. It doesn't always work. It can be as bad as anything else, obviously. We believe in total depravity. We believe in the slippery slope, which is gravity plus total depravity. But, you know, this, it's like democracy. Winston Churchill said, democracy is the best form of, it's terrible, but it's the best. So Presbyterianism can be pretty terrible too.
Sure. I think there's something in there that, I don't remember if you guys highlighted it, if it was maybe in the conversation that you had with Camden on Reformed Forum or back, could have been Todd and Carl. I've ingested a lot of this content in the last couple of months. So here we are. But, you alluded to it there that there's something, grounded or earthy about, the lay elders or the ruling elders, as opposed to kind of the highbrow white tower or ivory tower kind of thing that can happen with the educated class, if you will, of teaching elder. And, you know, I've kind of observed, I remember when we were chatting with James Dolezal about divine simplicity and getting into classical theism, a lot of the drift is coming from, not from, you know, the lay people that are just sitting in Sunday school and going to church each week faithfully, but from these guys that are pushing the educational envelope and feel like they have to add something, and they keep trying to change things, and they keep trying to outsmart, you know, and get too clever. And Dr. Dolezal made a comment about, like, you run into, I'm going to paraphrase him poorly, but he was like, if you start to divorce yourself too much from that grounded realist metaphysic, like I can believe what's in front of me, you know, or take the broader culture, you know, what's a woman? And the fact that we even have to ask these questions or even, you know, entertain a question like this that people are having, and nuance it to death to the point that the words are meaningless. I think if I'm understanding correctly, I think some of that same impulse can come up in the clerical class, if you will. And I don't necessarily like to use that language. We're a staunchly anti-communist podcast as well, but it's all I got at the moment. So I think that I think there is something true to that. And just in my own church, that's all I have, my own church, my own session, and the deacon board, I do notice that. We have some elders that tend to be more, some ruling elders that tend to be more theologically inclined. And then there's others that are just, they've been at the same church for 50 years, married to the same woman for 50 years, and they just show up every Sunday. They call up the young men in the church relentlessly to come after them because they aren't seeking out that discipleship. And that faithfulness and that biblical literacy that isn't bogged down by all of the heady stuff necessarily, and no need to try to be clever, it does encourage me tremendously to see people that are theologically smart and biblically literate, but they're not caught up in their own wit. They don't think they've outgrown the need for boundary markers in creeds and confessions and good preaching, which I think is something else that in Presbyterianism we have our Westminster standards, which I think are pretty good. And as I understand it, and maybe I misunderstand this, but as I understand the process of making amendments to our Book of Church Order, BCO, or any of the overtures, it's intentionally a lengthy process. It's not something that just happens in one go. Am I understanding that correctly, the way that things go up to General Assembly, get voted on, and then get sent back to the presbyteries, like what happened last year with the overtures?
Yeah, it takes three votes to change the Book of Church Order of the PCA. You've got to, actually it takes more than that, a local session or presbytery has to pass the overture and send it. So there's a vote. Actually, ideally there'll be a local church presbytery, local church session vote on it. Then a presbytery, so there's two votes. Then it goes to General Assembly. The overtures committee will vote on it up or down, just a recommendation. So there's three votes. Then the General Assembly will vote on it. It only takes a majority to pass it at that stage. There's four votes. Then it goes to the presbyteries, and if it's a constitutional change, it's got to pass two-thirds of the presbyteries. So there's five votes. And then it comes back to the next General Assembly for another simple majority vote right at the beginning of the assembly. So there's six votes. So yes, it's very difficult to change the Constitution. And of course, you know, it should be, yes, there's a lot of steps and a lot of fail safes and a lot of chances to shoot something down.
Which I think is a tremendous strength.
We can even change the Westminster Confession if we want to. But that, I think it's that process on steroids. I think it's a 75% vote of the presbyteries or the assembly. I don't have it in front of me. But there's an even higher standard, but we could amend the confession, but that's not going to happen.
No. That's awesome. Thank you. Resby, do you have anything to add to that on the OPC side or just Presbyterians kind of intentionally making it difficult to change things?
Let me preface Resby's remarks like this. Well, first of all, we had 45 overtures, which is, you know, a request to change the Constitution or make a statement or do something. The OPC General Assembly rarely has more than a few overtures. They don't do change. Their Book of Church Order is cloth bound. It's in a hardback book. Ours is in a loose leaf binder. So hats off to the denomination that doesn't like to change.
Yeah, I've got one under my computer desk. I mean, and when we say cloth bound, let's see how many pages. Sorry if you heard it. So including the index, 229 pages. So, I mean, that's really
light reading.
That bad. 220. And then you hit the topical index there. I don't really have anything to add.
Yeah, what's ours that? Our BCO is like 300 pages. The parts of it aren't binding.
And how many pages are intentionally left blank?
68 yeah. Pages says this page intentionally left blank.
Oh, I see so that.
Ours is all killer, no filler, man. But no, I don't have anything to add on procedure, but just more of like a second to it is there's a holy slowness to Presbyterianism that I think, if you see it as anything other than endearing, you know, you may want to question why it is that you feel that way. We've seen and nothing in the last 2 years has taught me that rash, quick decisions are good ones to make, yeah. Especially when they are sweeping. So it's good that these things have to start at a small level, and it's good that it takes more than a simple majority to ultimately change them, you know, at the ultimate level of the denomination. So. For that to be the case, it is a very good, not perfect, but very, very good safeguard against error.
Yeah, and we talk the way we do because we want to model that holy slowness. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Yeah, the length of our podcast is just verbally, intentionally leaving pages blank.
See, I just fill those gaps with our fun little soundboard here that I've just still getting used to it because I used to go in manually after every episode and drop everything in, and now it's a little bit more like a radio show. But
Oh, I used to hold my phone on speakerphone and hit an app. So
amazing.
Yeah,
I love it. Well, as we kind of wrap up this, do you gentlemen have any closing thoughts? I mean, I personally, if I wasn't already Presbyterian, I'm sold. But do you guys have any other thoughts on Presbyterian polity, the biblical nature of it, the practical benefit of it, and or just your personal preference towards it? I mean, we've already alluded to a lot of that, but just any closing thoughts and book or content recommendations for folks whose appetites have been wet and they want to learn more about this kind of quirky form of Christianity that we call Presbyterianism that we love.
Well, we left out the most important thing, the most important benefit for church members is that church members have much more protection under Presbyterian church government than any other form that I know of. If a church member feels that they've been wronged by their local session, they've got the right of appeal to the presbytery. And the presbytery shouldn't use our very complicated process against that person. It's our duty to help them to appoint, practically appoint counsel and help them, meet the deadlines and send in the right document. And we're really supposed to bend over backwards. I've been on a couple of judicial commissions in my presbytery, and we really try to do the right thing. Our process is complicated enough that in the wrong hands, it certainly could be abused, but it shouldn't be. So a congregant can appeal all the way to the General Assembly, which is to say to our top level standing judicial commission. In a congregational church, in a local church, that ability is not there. There's not anyone above that local church typically. That's a hard thing. I would also say that congregants are protected from dictatorial leadership because they can complain to the presbytery, who is obligated to investigate every complaint. So if the session is doing wrong, or the pastor, or even if another member has wronged a member, and the local session can't or won't or doesn't do the right thing, that could be kicked up to the presbytery. And we do have this principle because we do have a congregational element that there's a tradition that and it's even written, it's in our Book of Church Order, that ordinarily a great deference is given to the lower court decision, because we figure that the local session knows more about what's going on than the presbytery or the standing judicial commission may. But that's not to say that we always defer to the lower court. And one of the ways that this is really the most important, the two most important features process-wise in Presbyterianism, first would be review of records. All the session minutes of every church in a presbytery are reviewed by a committee of the presbytery. So in as much as minutes of meetings reflect it, the actions of the local church are reviewed by the next court up. And in the same way, the presbytery's records are reviewed by the General Assembly. So it's very imperfect, but there's someone looking over everyone's shoulder. There just is. And again, it's an imperfect system, but things are caught, things are corrected, and people act differently when they know that someone is going to be evaluating their records. And if the form of the records is not right, the local session or presbytery can get in trouble. If if you know, if they never record receiving any members or dismissing members or electing officers, they're in trouble for, you know, maybe they're doing those things, but they can get in trouble for simply not recording those things. Mm-hmm. So that's very important, beyond the right of appeal. But the other thing that's so important is that while pastors are never imposed on a congregation, every pastor in the PCA is examined, tested, evaluated by the presbytery. Churches call their pastors, but the pastors have to be approved by presbytery. So you know that there's a minimum doctrinal standard, that their character is looked into. Again, this is always subject to mistake and error and a normal human frailty. But there are people looking out for you, at more than one level in a Presbyterian church. And, you know, we hear a lot about abuse, all the abuse committees and study committees and scandals. But I mean, this is just anecdotal. This is from my point of view. I don't see as many sexual abuse cases in Presbyterian churches as I do in others. It's not scientific, but it's just harder, you know, to kind of go rogue or slip through in a Presbyterian church. It ought to be. I just don't think we have the problems, and I think part of it has to do with the process. It does work to some degree, and I think some Presbyterians are reticent to say that, but I can confidently say that we don't have all the problems that other churches do in this regard. And the problems we do have, I think, are typically not as severe. And that's not because we're better. I hope it's just because the Bible tells us how to do these things, and we try to do them.
That's great.
Well, amen. I love that.
Well, y'all, Resby, B-Rad, been great having you. This has been generally a very informative episode. This is very technical, but very helpful. I think it'll be useful, and I was thrilled to have you guys on. And hopefully this won't be our last time chatting.
Hopefully, we didn't scare them away. Yeah,
yeah. I enjoyed this. So, guys, let us always remember that whatever you do,
whether you eat or drink,
do all to the glory of God.
Soli Deo Gloria.